Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. This is your show host, Randy Fine. After 2 decades in the study and practice of medicine, today's special guest, Sarah Seidelman, took a 3-month sabbatical to search for a way to feel good again. Having witnessed human suffering early in her career and within her own family, she longed for a way to address more than just the physical needs of her patients and to live in a lighter, more conscious way. Her new book, Swimming with Elephants, tells the eccentric, sometimes poignant, and occasionally hilarious experience of a working mother and wife undergoing a bewildering vocational shift from physician to shamanic healer. During that tumultuous period of answering her call, she met an elephant who would become an important companion on her journey. And Sarah is going to tell us all about that journey and even more, and it's fascinating. So let's get started, and I will introduce you to Sarah Bamford Seidelman, MD. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Randy. Thanks for having me on, and I love this theme music. I was like, wow, that song is so beautiful and something we all need to remember, like, no matter how bad it is, everything.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Fine. It's like, wow, so I love it.
Yeah, it's so powerful, and I encourage you and everyone who's listening to listen to the entire song. You can go on YouTube and listen to it, and it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. It does speak
and
volumes.
And beautiful that
about,
it's in honor of Amy's life, you know. I mean, I think she's somebody.
I know. It was such a find, such a gold mine that I couldn't believe it. So anyway, why don't you tell us about your story, you know, how things started?
Yeah. So my husband's a physician, too. So the two of us were working long hours, and we had 4 little kids. So you can imagine lots of long hours, intense jobs, and then really intense taking care of 4 kids and trying to be good parents and good partners and all that kind of thing. And during this sort of overwhelming period, I mean, that's an overwhelming thing just in general, being a parent of 4 kids and working full-time for anybody. But I started to feel more and more kind of disconnected and, you know, less engaged at work, which when you're a physician, a pathologist who's charged with, you know, looking, my job was to determine whether, you know, a particular person had a malignancy or not a malignancy. And sometimes, you know, based on the decisions that I would make, you know, they would you know, remove an organ, for example, or do major surgery, or, you know, decide to do some sort of treatment. So I knew that not being engaged was not a good option for any of us, you know.
Right.
And it really bothered me. So I began to try to figure out what was going on. You know, did I need to, like, maybe train in another subspecialty? You know, was it simply that I just needed to be more intellectually stimulated? You know, once you kind of master something, or, you know, there's sometimes we just need to explore something new. But over time, what I kind of recognized is what I was really yearning for was to kind of to be able to serve people in a way that I had wanted to for a very long time, but I had sort of refused the call when I was in medical school. And I talk about that in the book, that as I looked back in my life, I realized that in medical school, I had had some encounters with patients that left me feeling that I really was not prepared to really meet them where they needed to be met, or where I felt I wanted to be meeting them, which was sort of at the level of the soul. So not just at the physical level, like taking care of, you know, maybe a patient in the hospital, making sure they had, you know, sufficient numbers of platelets in their blood, or, you know, checking their blood chemistry and those physical things, or making sure somebody had a proper medication. But it was more like, especially in particular in life and death situations, I wanted to be able to really speak to people, patients, about what was happening to them, not just in the physical, but what was happening to them spiritually. Although back in medical school, I had no idea that was what was going on. It was just a very confusing experience, which led me to choose a specialty in which I would not have direct patient contact for the most part.
Okay. And so you were confused, and you sought out a life coach, right?
Yes. So here I am. I'm like mid-40s, got all these kids, we're working our tails off, exhausted, starting to feel a little like, wow, is this, I don't know that I can do this for the rest of my life. I planned to work till I was, you know, 70, 75, loving what I did. So I knew I wasn't depressed. So I had heard of this newfangled concept of a life coach. And I was like, I didn't dare tell anybody I was hiring one, but I did decide to hire one. Because I felt it was like, well, why shouldn't you just know how to live your life? It felt like such a failure on my part. But anyway, I'm so glad I did, because it was really powerful to hire somebody to assist me. And what my life coach, and I talk about her in the book, mylifecoach.com is Michelle's website if anybody's interested. She's wonderful. And she really listened to me. I think that would be the primary thing she did, and helped me to kind of refocus on things that felt good to me. And over time, I started to enjoy work more. It became kind of more bearable again. But after a couple of years in that place of it being more bearable, I realized I still had this yearning. And so eventually, with Michelle's help and my own kind of planning, I took a sabbatical for 3 months. In order to get to that place, we had to make some financial decisions. Like, we sold a big house that we were living in, and I talk about that in the book Swimming with Elephants, because that was quite a process. Kind of moved from a big fancy house to a more simple house so that we would have that freedom financially, you know, so that I could take a little time off. And on that sabbatical, which I highly recommend to anybody who's sort of feeling stuck or lost with their vocation, it's just a marvelous thing. And sometimes you return to work recharged with whatever it was you were doing, or sometimes you get a new idea. But in my case, I began to spend all this time outside. And prior to that, I mean, so many hours either taking care of kids or sitting in a fluorescent lit office, I had become so disconnected from nature. And just with a few little walks in the woods with my dogs, I started to realize, wow, I'm feeling a lot better out here. And I don't know what's happening to me, but it's like I was feeling so much better than I had in like years. And during that sabbatical, I also stumbled into this ancient idea that nature, and in particular wild animals, may have helpful messages for us. And if we could just pay attention and get those, receive those messages, you know, we'll be able to move forward on our path in a more powerful way. And I thought, as a you know, a North American sort of trained, a Western trained physician, I mean, and growing up, in a sort of a Northern Minnesota, I had never been introduced to this idea. I thought it sounded like completely wacky and kind of absurd. But at the time, Randy, I was like so confused and so lost. I was like, well, I'm open to it. You know, I'm open to anything that might be able to help me. And it also sounded fun because I'm an animal lover. So I was like, just started playing with the idea of receiving, you know, just seeing if I could receive the messages with some simple tool that we can talk about later on the show if people, if you'd like. But as I began to, I was like, I started to notice that it was actually quite powerful and it was helping me feel good in small incremental ways, these messages that I was receiving. And then I began to share it with some of my friends who, you know, tended to be overachieving women, you know, in law or in medicine also, you know, smart, intellectually focused people. And I remember being shocked and surprised because I was really timid about sharing it with them, but I was kind of excited about it. I was like, hey, guys, you know, you might be able to get messages from animals. It's kind of been helping me, and I don't know, what do you think? And I started sharing some of the resources on one weekend, a girls' weekend. And I was just flabbergasted because one by one, all these dear friends of mine were like, whoa, like they were each making powerful discoveries. And that's when I realized, okay, this may seem really totally out of the box and completely bizarre compared, you know, and not typical of our culture, but whatever this is, this nature connection, this wisdom we can get from animals, apparently it is not, you know, it is powerful in some kind of a way. And, you know, I continued to eventually I started a podcast with a coaching friend, which is called Squirrel Radio, The Magic of Animal Totems. It's still on iTunes. And we just started to do an animal every week. And it was mind-blowing. People were calling in and telling these incredible stories of animals that had come into their dreams or animals that had showed up in their lives and really helped people. One of the most poignant examples that I can remember was a woman called in and talked about when she was a little child, she was unable to live with her mom because her mom was a drug addict. So they put her with her grandma, who was an alcoholic and abusive, but at least she was, she was able to like keep food on the table and so forth. And this little girl at the time was about 4. And at night, when she would lay in her bed, these huge Clydesdale horses, 2 of them, would come. And they would sort of stand near her bed and they would say to her, "What do you want us to do?" And she would say, you know, "You need to sit down." And then they would sit like at attention for her. And they gave her this feeling, first of all, they were huge. And they gave her this feeling that she was in charge, you know, that she was powerful too. Because you can imagine a little child in that situation is feeling pretty powerless. And right. I just remember story after story, similar to that, but different ways. It might be an actual animal in real life coming to somebody. And I tell a lot of stories in the book about, you know, examples of that, but I just realized there was a great power to this work that wasn't something I completely understood, but I wanted to continue pursuing it.
So the first animal that you talk about in the book is the bear. And this was, it seemed in the book as if this is really before you went on this full journey, full-blown journey of shamanic healing and things like that. How did this bear come to you, and what did you see, and what did it represent?
Yeah, so right around the time, right before I went on my sabbatical, I had signed up for a coach training program, because being life coached, I realized was helpful, and I wanted to learn more about how that worked. And during that time, I had this dream, and it was this huge, like 10-foot-tall bear, giant. Actually, there were more than one. There were several of them in the dream, and they were kind of terrifying. They were huge, and they were throwing around these giant gas tanks, like natural gas tanks you see in rural areas, you know, they were throwing them around like they were juggling them practically in our backyard in the dream. And I remember in the dream, like running upstairs to tell the adults, like, you guys, there's this terrible thing happening in the backyard, these bears, and like they seem really angry. And everybody's like, yeah, Sarah, they were all like drinking wine and like talking, and people weren't interested. And I did a little dream analysis on it, which I had been learning in coach training with Martha Beck, who's a marvelous, amazing mentor of mine, and she has an amazing coach training program and books. And she, through this training, I'd learned this simple analysis, and I discovered was these bears in my dream represented my creativity. And the problem was is they were starving. That's why they were angry and throwing around these gas tanks and why it was rather explosive and a scary feeling. And all they wanted to do is to be fed. The bears needed to be fed, so I needed to feed my creativity. And that made so much sense to me. It was like it resonated so deeply because, you know, as any parent knows who's like pursuing a career at full on, full throttle, and then has children or other great responsibilities, maybe you're caretaking an adult parent, maybe something else is going on in your life. Pretty soon, all that juicy stuff, the fun hobbies, the little fun side things that we do that make, you know, make our hearts leap for joy kind of get squeezed out sometimes. And that was certainly true for me. I mean, I hadn't been creative in a really significant way in a long time. And so I began to allow myself to play more creatively. And that in and itself is, it was really healing and strange. I talk about in the book how I started getting drawn into decoupage, which is like the old-fashioned, old-timey art of like gluing images onto glass.
Right.
Well, and other objects too, but it was so weird. Randy, I was like, I don't know why, but I'm obsessed with like gluing old-fashioned images of like cows and chickens. And it started with domestic animals, and then it grew into more wild animals like elephants and giraffes and tigers and butterflies. And I kept trying to understand like what was going on with me. I would say to my friend, like, why am I doing this? This is nuts. Or I'd be, like, it'd be 10:30 at night where I should have been going to bed because I had to get up and do a conference at the hospital the next day. And I would be, like, scanning in these old-time postcards. And my husband would be like, are you ever coming to bed? And I'd be like, let me just one more, you know, vintage rabbit with a little top hat on. I'll be there. And I had no business doing it, but it's like I couldn't stop. And I think that it's because like our soul somehow already knows where we're going, and it starts to be drawn to things that really, really often make no sense. And that's why I think being creative is a really wonderful way to kind of find your way forward. If you're feeling lost, it's just to paint or color or draw or decoupage or knit or whatever it is that you feel drawn, or write music, whatever it is. Because strangely it will contain some of the clues that you need. Because looking back, you know, the animals had been already starting to work on me long before I ran into that idea that wild animals and their spirits can inspire us and, you know, really help us out on this life path we're all on.
So when you would go out and take walks and the animals, you would receive, you know, information from the animals. How did you receive that? What did that feel like?
Yeah, so it's a really simple process, and I just, here's one thing people can just play with. You know, you go out on a walk, say you're going to walk in your neighborhood or not walk on a trail somewhere near your home, is just to set the intention, I'm going to receive helpful information from the beasties that I run into today. And I say beasties because it can be anything from an ant to maybe a more mythological creature like a unicorn or a dragon. Some people do meet unicorns in the forest. It's been documented, right, by people's stories throughout the ages. But maybe you see, you know, a reflection of a dragon or the shape of a dragon in a stone or a tree. There's many ways that we can encounter beasties. So we can actually see the literal creature, or maybe we see evidence of them, the hole that they dug or the bite marks in a leaf or the scat they leave behind. So you're going to set your intention that you're going to receive a powerful information from a beastie that's going to help you with a particular issue. So maybe you're struggling with a relationship. Maybe you're in grief right now and you're trying to like find your way through that. Maybe something else is going on with your health or you're having a challenge that way. And then you're just going to open all your senses, just kind of notice with what you hear, what you feel, what you sense, what you smell, and even what you just perceive, because we all have different perceptions. I'll just give you a little example of one day when this was happening to me and I was working with this tool very early on. So I went out with this intention. I want to get helpful information, or I'm going to receive helpful information from a beastie, and it's about helping me to write my first book. Because I, on my sabbatical, I started getting this really strong craving to write a book. And I wasn't exactly sure what that book was, but I had some ideas. And I had no clue how to write a book. I'd never done anything like that. So that day, I was really disappointed because the only creature that seemed to really catch my eye was an ant. And I was kind of like, you know, some days you're begging for like an, you want an eagle, you want something like a wolf to walk up to you or something, you know, that you perceive as powerful. But I was like, well, it's a Monday morning and I've got an ant. So I went home and I was like, okay, this ant was, you know, tooling across the sidewalk, not at Mach 70 or anything. It was just, you know, toddling along the sidewalk. And I was like, what could the message be? And then what I recognize is that, you know, ants build these amazing sandcastles, you know, incredible relative to their size. And how they do that is one tiny grain of sand at a time, you know, slowly in a rush, bringing that sand piece over to the pile and then going back and getting another one. And I was like, okay, what would it look like for me to pick up a piece of sand and move it towards my pile in the process of writing a book? And so that day, I opened a file on my computer, and I saved it as a blank file, and I just saved it as, you know, Sarah's new book with, you know, a title that I was sort of imagining might be a good title. And then I just typed in a few quick ideas, like what were some of the things maybe I wanted to cover. And then I closed the file. And it doesn't seem like much, but now the file exists. Now I have a place to go write things down. Now, you know, there's a beginning there, and it was nothing hard. I mean, it didn't give me a migraine. I didn't end up in my bed exhausted. I wasn't too scary to do. I didn't have to show it to anybody or talk about it. So that's the power of a very simple message. And I always tell people, sometimes we don't always get what we want in terms of maybe the animal that shows up isn't one we actually are excited about. Or maybe we even find them unpleasant or scary, but often the message is one that we need to get. We will get what we need. That's what I learned.
Yes, we do. We do. Not always what we want. So mm-hmm. you learn to transcend in order to connect with spirit animals. What is transcendence, and what was that like for you?
Yeah, I don't usually use that term, but I think of it as, but I think I know what you're getting at, which is like to alter our consciousness so that
yes.
we can perceive, you know, some higher wisdom and some higher knowledge, or we might say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because so you say you enjoy transcendent experiences on a pretty regular basis. So what did you mean by that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, I talk about in another book that I wrote before this, which is called Born to Freak, which is sort of a love letter to people who have been diagnosed with anything in the DSM book, which would be, you know, ADHD, ADD, bipolar, depression, anxiety, Asperger's, autism.
Right.
That, you know, I just write this love letter saying what I'd learned was that all of those people, including myself, who was diagnosed with ADD, that we are, you know, specially hardwired to be sort of conduits of this, of these higher experiences. I think everybody has that potential should it be developed. But I really wanted people that were in this subgroup of people to know that. And one of the beautiful things that I learned about ADHD, where there are a lot of difficult things about it. It can be very hard to focus on something that you find uninteresting, such as doing your taxes. Or, for example, for myself, as I began to find pathology less and less interesting, that can be a real problem. You know, we need to do our taxes. Or if you're a pathologist, you need to be able to scan a pap smear with 100,000 cells and find the two malignant ones so that you can do your job properly, you know. But what I also, you know, so there's a lot of focus on the negatives and the downside of ADHD and all these other conditions as well, or these labels, shall we say. But what I also realized is that people with my condition, quotation marks, or label of ADHD, is that we are also able to kind of connect in with high vibrational experiences, like when we sometimes are, like, for example, maybe I go down to the Lake Superior today and see the sun sparkling on the water. Because of my makeup, I seem to be able to, like, go into a state of wonder and awe that I notice that people that are really different from me maybe don't as easily step into that. I think we all have that potential, but I think that some of us, yeah, we're born with a sort of a talent for being able to see that wonder, that awe, or make those connections, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It does, absolutely. Because
so,
if you're a very focused kind of person, then you're not open to what's around you. You're focusing on what you're focusing on. So that does open you up. That makes sense.
Yeah, and I think, like, when I look at bipolar in my family, we have quite a bit of bipolar, and I can see in my own self, like, I can really tap into some very high vibrational, like, woo, I get giddy and, like, so in awe or just in a state of wonder, which is sort of like a very high experience, almost like, I guess, just almost like being high, for lack of a better explanation. But then I can also, so too, because of that openness and that sensitivity to what's going, I can also dive really, really low. So it's kind of learning how to manage those highs and lows, or maybe not manage them so much as, like, ride them and experience that and be okay with it.
Okay.
So
that makes sense. That makes sense. So your book is called Interestingly Enough, Swimming with Elephants, My Unexpected Pilgrimage from Physician to Healer. Why did you call your book, now I read the book, so I know, but why did you call the book Swimming with Elephants?
Well, I don't want to give too much of a spoiler, you know, alert, but one of the animals that I connected to, at a particular point in my journey, it was time for my sabbatical to be over, and I had a decision to make, which was go back to work or courageously pursue this other field of study, which really fascinated me, which was shamanism and kind of this taking deeper, this idea that there are spirits and you know, a deeper connection to nature that can heal us and help us and inform us. And at that time, I happened to meet a special elephant who really began to help me and encourage me to really let it all hang out, let everybody see what I was afraid to show them, let them, you know, really be myself, just be vulnerable, be open, talk about my story, talk about my strangeness, and really confess all that, because that was going to be my highest path. And so, and elephants are marvelous too, because, you know, in the book I talk about how I went on an amazing journey to South Africa, which is where I got to meet elephants in person for the first time, other than maybe I had seen one in a zoo or a circus as a child, but in the wild, which is the best place to view animals. And I observed this. It was really funny. We were observing these elephants eating marula fruit, which is, there are these trees that elephants absolutely love marula fruit. It's like this juicy, sweet fruit. And after time, it will actually ferment and kind of turn into almost like a wine. And they love it. They'll, like, gorge themselves on this. And so one day we were observing this elephant that there was, like, two marula fruits, like, way at the top of this branches of this tree that otherwise had been decimated. Like, they had pulled down all the branches, taken all the fruit, but there was, like, one fruit or two fruits up there. And I observed, like, first of all, how destructive elephants are. They make a big mess when they're eating. Like, they have no problem sort of making a huge mess. And the other thing is what the elephant did is it didn't sort of, like, give up, because it couldn't reach this top fruit. But what it did was it wrapped its trunk around the base of this tree and simply with brute force ripped the thing out of the ground and dropped the tree and then got this marula fruit. And the message for me was twofold. First of all, elephants are messy as hell, you know, but that they get what they want. And sometimes, you know, you have to use the power of your own soul or your own self to get what you want. not necessarily that brute force is a way to get what you want, but you know that, that elephants have this way of getting what they needed, getting what they wanted, and that somehow it was okay to be messy. And of being a person who had been diagnosed with ADHD, I mean, we carry a lot of shame about like how messy we are because we're constantly being incredibly creative. So we are, we're like little whirling dervishes, or I can be, you know, just spinning up messes wherever I go. And eventually I do get them cleaned up, but that's kind of part of the creative process. And so it helped me to be able to embrace my own creative process and kind of drop some of that shame around messiness or what looks like to other people as complete disorder. Because sometimes in that disorder, we can see what we're working, and that's how we need to work often, is kind of work messy and then, you know, eventually clean it up.
Well, thank you for helping us to understand that. Now, the elephant, when you said you met an elephant, you didn't meet the one initially, you did not meet in a physical sense, right? This was through...
Right. That was more observational at first. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then one appeared to me. So as I began to dive, I left my job sort of mostly. I was working a little bit part-time, just helping out a little bit. But mostly I was pursuing shamanism by this point, and I went on what's called a shamanic journey. And a shamanic journey is simply a technique that's been used all over the globe for thousands and thousands of years, where one alters their consciousness using sonic driving, which is a fancy word for drumming or rattling, or in like Australia they use didgeridoo. Some people use click sticks, but it's some kind of sonic driving is the most common way to alter your consciousness so that you can have a direct experience with the divine. You know, so many people, you know, we think, well, we've got to wait until the day we die to go, you know, connect with the divine. But with this particular tool, you can go tonight if you'd like. And that may sound heretical to people, and that's okay.
No, not to me.
I know I was very skeptical about these things when I began learning about them. But in any case, when I went on a particular shamanic journey, I met this elephant. And her name is Alice. And she was very funny. And, well, she is very funny and very buoyant and very... had a really sweet sensibility, but really encouraged me in every way that now is the time to really come out and let my, you know, let my freak flag fly, you know, really stop worrying what everybody was thinking about me. And you can imagine, you know, I'm a pathologist in a fairly small city where, you know, this is your reputation, you know, this is your identity. I'm a doctor. And now I'm, you know, mostly at home and talking to spirits and spirit animals and getting a lot of messages from nature. And, like, it was really hard to – I would run into my, you know, my partners at from work, and I would think to myself, oh, my God. Like, I just felt like I was living a double life. Like, here's me talking to them, but I can't talk about this with them. I don't know that they would understand. And I'm not even sure how to even begin. You know, it was really hard to bridge that gap for a long time.
I'll bet. Yeah, you know, it doesn't shock me. Nothing really shocks me because I'm so open to these kind of things. But I could imagine trying to explain that to people who have never heard of it or experienced it. So you say there's many different roles that a shamanic practitioner can play, and you talk about four important ones. The first one being core beasties, core beastie infusion, which is what?
Yes, so I talk about, so this is, so shamanic healing typically is involving restoring a person, restoring balance to an individual or to a community or to an environment. But in terms of for an individual, one of the main healings that the spirits will often recommend to help a person who's struggling for whatever reason is to have a spirit animal brought to them. Or what I like to call a core beastie, a beastie that, again, because it can describe anything from a dragonfly up to a woolly mammoth, for example, or a phoenix, another mythical creature. But to go to the spirit world and ask for an animal to volunteer itself, a beastie to volunteer itself to help this person sort of at their core. And these ideas might sound so radical if you've never been introduced to these concepts. But the idea that that spirit animal will share the love and compassion of the universe with that person and act as sort of a protector, a healer, a guide, a mentor, and that when we live our lives in a way that honors that particular unique beastie, we too will thrive and we will be able to do whatever it is that we came here on Earth to do.
So I fill my house. It's absolutely crazy, but I fill it with frogs. Frogs this, frogs that. I got frog planters. I got frog everything in my house, and I just absolutely adore them. Is that probably an indication of a spirit animal that's influencing me?
I would definitely invite you to explore it, for sure. In fact, that's a lot of times that can be the biggest clue. People will be like, I have no idea what my spirit animal is. And I'll be like, well, go home and kind of pretend to be an anthropologist in your home, like study yourself as sort of like as a neutral observer and see what you see. And sometimes people would be like, you won't believe this, Sarah, but I have coyote curtains, coyote sheets, a coyote art, coyote sculptures, a coyote painted down my driveway. Yeah. I mean, it's just like hilarious because it's like hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, I mean,
I love it all along.
For me, it's lizards and frogs, but I just go wild. Well, I go wild over both of them, actually. Okay, so the second thing is soul retrieval. What is that?
So soul retrieval is something that the shamanic practitioner performs. They alter their consciousness to go look for parts of a person's soul that have been lost through either traumatic incidents or through sometimes we surrender a part of our soul, kind of jettison it, saying, if I stop letting this, you know, if I leave this part of myself behind, then in this marriage, maybe we'll have a chance, or I can keep my job, or I can whatever. You know, we make a pact with our soul and we release part of it. And the concept being that when we're conceived and come to Earth, we have our whole soul. It's this beautiful, you might imagine it like a beautiful golden ball of light. But over time, every one of us has things that happen to us where we lose parts of ourselves. And over time, if we've lost quite a few parts of our soul, what can happen is we start to feel really disempowered. We start to be less effective in our lives. We might be more vulnerable and open to being the recipient of stuff that really doesn't serve us, either spiritually or in other ways. Kind of like, almost like it's a void, you know, that's there that sometimes, you know, nature pours a vacuum, so things come that will fill that space. And so the soul retrieval process brings back more, for example, if we were working with you, Randy, it would bring more Randiness back to Randy. And in that way, when you've got all the randiness in the world, then you become this person that can, that's kind of a funny double entendre because of, you know, laughing. But that, you know, then you can be more effective and more of who you really are.
That's soul retrieval.
And I give an example in the book.
Okay.
Yeah, where that happened for me and what the significance of it for my life.
Okay. So I'm just trying to push through this because I want to be able to get to all these. Extraction. So that you kind of talked about that. You said sometimes we have stuff that doesn't belong to us.
Yes. And so that process is the spirits through the practitioner remove things that don't belong. Could be old ways of being, could be old anger that's been thrown at us. Can be any number of things. But when we remove that, it makes room for more power and of our own soul to return, or as I was mentioning, the spirit animals can also fill that void with the power, the love, the compassion of the universe. So that in shamanism, we say when you walk full of power on the earth, we are more effective.
Okay, and the last one is psychopomp work, and that's an odd name. What is that?
Yeah, that is where the idea that when we are in the process of dying, a shamanic practitioner may be present with a person to help them in that process of making their transition from this world into the next. And also, sometimes when people die under tragic or accidental circumstances, for example, in a house fire, a suicide, a murder, or can be a really, you know, something very sudden where the person had no preparation, had no idea that they were going to be dying. In shamanism, we believe that, or we say that that soul can get, that spirit of that person can become trapped because it, in this reality and not transcend to the spirit realities where they can continue, you know, where the soul can continue to evolve. And so sometimes we need to help that spirit to move on if it wants to. You know, it's something that we do in, you know, with a lot of love and respect and compassion for that spirit.
Right.
And sometimes those spirits are obviously suffering. Yeah.
So,
because
yeah, and
they,
we would, and in layman's terms, we would call that earthbound or ghosts, something like
so,
that,
yes,
right?
That's
okay.
Right.
So, we're coming down to the end. I hate to have to rush you because this is also fascinating, but time just goes, and we only have about 2 minutes left. So, your book is Swimming with Elephants, My Unexpected Pilgrimage from Physician to Healer, and we are talking today to Sarah Bamford Seidelman, S-E-I-D-E-L-M-A-N-N. Sarah, how do we get your book, and how do we contact you?
You can get the book wherever books are sold and order it from your independent bookseller or from Amazon and you or Kindle. And my website is followyourfeelgood.com. And if you're wanting to do a journey to discover who your core beastie or your spirit animal is, if you subscribe to my site, you'll get a download where I drum and talk you through that experience to see if you can discover who yours is.
Cool. Wow. That's
yeah.
Awesome. What a great offer. Okay. And what was your what's your website again? I couldn't hear you very
followyourfeelgood.com.
Oh, followyourfeelgood.com. Perfect. Perfect. Love it. Okay. Wow. Well, we covered a lot of territory in a short amount of time. And like I said, I wish we had more. But I want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your book with us and your journey and opening up our eyes to a new reality that we may not have yet either experienced or known was there. So thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much, Randy. It was a delight, and I look forward to future conversations.
Yes, thank you. Okay, well, you'll keep in touch. So I have to say goodbye, but, well, let's just say see ya, right? Instead of goodbye, we'll just say see ya. All right, so see ya, Sarah. See you again.
Randy. See ya.
Okay. So we are out of time for today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randygfine.com. And I hope you will join me on Friday this week where I will take your calls and answer your questions about your narcissistic abuse issues. The number to call on Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern is 424-220-1801. Please call in. I'll be happy to answer your questions. And that's all I have for you today. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randy Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randygfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randy G. Fine.